you know, there's a famous saying, they don't kill you because you're a Nazi, they call you a Nazi so they can kill you.
If your core premise is there are no naturally bad people, then you will cling to that even in the face of quite a lot of contrary evidence. It's very hard to get people to dislodge foundational components of their worldview.
According to the left, tech people, tech money is too powerful. Tech has had a huge impact in the last 6 years on bringing San Francisco to a place of, I don't want to call it sanity just yet, but it's much better than it was.
The NHS sucks, but I have to be honest, from the outside, it looks like the American system has some issues as well. Though equally, you know, we don't go around assassinating NHS managers.
This is the part that people really don't speak much about with Luigi. There was this really compelling story there. He seemed like he wanted to create a meme. He was this like strangely charismatic figure. So suddenly if like executives are on the table, certainly journalists are on the table, podcasters, and then what happens is Charlie Kirk. Had Luigi not happened, Charlie Kirk would still be alive. That is what I believe.
Welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington. And today I have the immense privilege of being joined all the way from the Bay Area by the CMO at Founders Fund, the founder of Pirate Wires, one of the most interesting, spicy, and consistently funny publications out there, and one of my absolute favorites, a man once called the most opinionated man in America, which I think has surely got to be an extremely high bar. Mike Solana, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So one of the most interesting things from the perspective of Britain over the last few years has been watching Silicon Valley pivot from the Obama era, very cozy relationship between the big social media platforms and the American administration to seeing Silicon Valley turn against the left. Mm-hmm. So I wondered if you could tell me a little bit about how that has come about. You know, what were the tectonic plates that shifted? Why was it that the statue of Obama was pushed ceremonially into the water and a golden one of Donald Trump erected? How did that come about?
Well, let's see. I mean, it's a great question. It is, I think it's the question of the day. It's, in my opinion, is actually the culture is changing again. At this moment, and I think that there's going to be a resurgence of left-wing tech money and power and influence. But I think it really, if you just trace it back to the early days, the Obama days, tech people are idealistic. And, you know, it's baked into the culture. It was like we're changing the world and we're all about the future. I think there was a lot of natural overlap between technologists and the Democratic Party. Certainly on social issues, the Republican Party seemed incorrect, I think, to the average tech person. But maybe more importantly is the question of, like, at least to me, the question I find more interesting within the tech community and who's going where is just where were the tech elites? And it was all good and well for the tech elites to support Obama back then. Culturally, it made a lot of sense. You know, all of their employees were voting for the Democrats. All of the money was going to the Democrats. And so that's where most founders were. But then what happens is Donald Trump wins the election in 2016, and social media is blamed for that. And every single left-wing outlet, which is all of them, demonizes the technology industry now relentlessly. You can go back and look at coverage of Facebook alone before and after the election of Donald Trump. And it was like glowing coverage to just overnight a 180. And it was like, these are the demons responsible.
Because the prequel to that, wasn't it, was the Arab Spring and Barack Obama's victory.
Yeah, it was
where,
like,
everyone just assumed that this was going to be an inherently left-wing phenomenon forever.
Exactly.
In perpetuity.
Obama's win was credited in large part to social media. His prowess on social media, you know, the youth and where they were. And so I think the culture really started to shift among the elites around that time because the press became so hostile for reasons that were really completely irrational and had nothing to do with the average person and no one really in tech. No one was activated in tech. There was only one person at that point in pretty much the entire industry who was, you know, an elite who supported Trump. That was Peter Thiel, and he was run out of town. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody supported him back then. None of his friends, none of the people now who are, like, you know, worshiping at the altar of Donald Trump in Washington, D.C., none of those guys were on his side, and none of them defended him back when he supported Trump. So that was a very different world. Everything starts to change because of the coverage, which introduces tech leaders to the concept of a hostile press, I think, for the first time. Mm. And as I was writing about back then, and I was constantly talking about, and certainly by 2020, when things were really exploding, was, you know, at the end of the day, Democrats are not your natural ally, because sure, you're building technology, but you're also business. Like, you're also very rich, and you're going to be really rich. So what also starts changing at that point? The Fortune 500 companies, like the top 10 most valuable companies in the country, become technology companies. So suddenly it's like wealth is amassed in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you have woke culture issues. So the woke culture issues were tearing the entire industry apart. And pretty much, I think without exception, all of the real leaders in tech shifted. Really out of just a sense of self-preservation. But the average tech employee did not. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a really important distinction that is sometimes lost in the idea that, okay, well, we have all these people in the Trump White House. It's like, well, who were they? They were prominent venture capitalists. They were founders of companies. They were friends of people, you know, at that highest level of tech. But the sort of run-of-the-mill everyday worker is still 80-20 a Democrat, except at certain, there are certain companies that things are more, not even skewed towards the Republicans, but more balanced. So I would say anything, most of the hardware companies just tend to be a little more balanced. Anything that's in Southern California rather than San Francisco tends to be a little more balanced. But yeah, I guess that's the history of it.
So that's how that came about. And you've also been very vocal on the way Californian politics has developed with that explosion of wealth and that real polarization of economic distribution. You've had a lot to say, for example, about public order issues in California, which is, I mean, for it to have percolated as far as England, you know, that there, you've had this issue with street crime, with rough sleeping, with, open drug use and so on. But the politics of that has been bitterly contested. There's been a real sort of, you can just do things, but only if you're homeless kind of thing, principle at work.
Yeah. So I guess I maybe... from the media side of things, innovated in this area. I believe that local politics, coverage of local politics is tech coverage in San Francisco, because that is the seat of tech's power and wealth. That's where everyone lives. And so the functioning of the city of San Francisco itself is a tech issue. And that is the way that I wrote about it. And that's the way that I continue to write about it. I think that it's relevant to tech. I think the political coverage is relevant to tech. And the reason is because, tech intersects everything. So, you know, technology, politics, culture, that was always my tagline at Pirate Wires, because I believe I was interested. Obviously they're all intersected, but that's specifically where the three of those things intersect. That's the place where I'm the most excited. How is technology changing the way we do politics? How is it changing the way we function culturally? And so in local politics, you know, it often became more simple and obvious. And like these people, it was not just like, you know, how are we talking about this stuff on Twitter, which shapes politics? It was like, these people want to destroy us, which is maybe the part that requires a little bit of a defense, and people think that I'm maybe a bit crazy.
So when you say these people want to destroy us, you know, what would that look? What's the playbook there? How does that look in practice?
It's what we're looking at is a conflict of power. And I think that people often look at the local politics of San Francisco and say, oh, this is just, you know, some lunatic leftist people and then some moderate Democrat people, and they're in conflict and it's like a very normal sort of fight. And, you know, so what? They want to pass a wealth tax in the state of California. That's just because they're left wing and they don't know how the economy works. And they don't really mean to drive the technology industry out of the state. But I actually think they do. So if you look back at what happened in 2020 in San Francisco, tech became activated on local politics before the re-election. Maybe, I guess it was sort of during the race while Trump was running, but they were most animated about local politics. There was a sort of pro-crime district attorney named Jessa Bowden. There were two completely outrageous Board of Ed people who were sitting down. And then, of course, there was, and both of them, were, all three of them were voted out of office in special elections. There were actual petitions that were gathered. Special election was held. They were ousted and replaced by then-Mayor London Breed.
So when you say pro-crime, what does that mean? Can you just please elaborate on that for anyone who's not a California native?
I mean, this is a problem across the entire country. Of the U.S., you certainly have DAs who are either Soros funded or sort of adjacent to that, who believe that they believe in criminal justice reform, and their view of what's happening in the world of crime and law and order is like, well, the biggest problem here is actually not the crime. The biggest problem is the way we've treated the criminals. They believe that that prison is inherently unjust. They want less of it. And their view is that it's counterproductive. I'm really trying to steel man it actually right now.
If I remember, the steel man version of the argument is that actually most of what gets castigated as crime is downstream of lack of resources or poor mental health provision or psychiatric services or housing provision. I think that this is the argument.
Well, and you know, racism
or institutional racism and assorted other structural social ills.
It's so hard to steel man it,
though.
And
that if we can address those structural social ills, then the problem of criminality will go away because there's no such thing as a naturally bad person. I think am I right in thinking that's the sort of core underlying premise? People are not naturally evil in any way at all. And all you have to do is take away the, it's a very sort of Rousseauian argument.
So you are, but I struggle with this because with this even being the steel man, or if there is a steel man, because had I just been encountering these arguments for the first time, I would say, okay, this is what they must believe. Mm-hmm. But I've heard these arguments for 10 years and things have gotten worse. So it's like, at what point, they're not stupid people. So at what point do you have to wonder, okay, there has to be some other motivation here. You know, if none of their ideas have worked, then, and the crime has not gotten better. In fact, it's only gotten worse. Certainly under COVID, this is what we saw when suddenly the burglars turned away from cars and started breaking into houses. What is actually motivating you to defend these people? I think that order is, or lack of order, is psychically really damaging. People left San Francisco.
You know, you got Carl Schmitt once, all human conflict is ultimately theological. And I mean, if you treat this as fundamentally a religious a philosophical stance, people find it easier to let go of specific policies than they do of an entire framework, an entire worldview.
Right.
And
yes.
if your core premise is there are no naturally bad people, then you will cling to that even in the face of quite a lot of contrary evidence. I mean, I think that's probably what I would submit as a the most charitable available explanation for why things continue, you know, in the teeth of all the evidence that actually this is your reasoning from faulty premises. Mm. Like, it's very hard to get people to dislodge foundational components of their worldview.
Yeah, it's certainly also identity based. You know, they like. My sense is that the people who support these policies like to be seen as the kinds of people who support these policies, and that's
like
more
being a nice person means seeing the best in everybody. Mm-hmm. Why are you not a nice person, Mike?
Right.
Are you a bad person?
Exactly. Yeah. And I yes, which you're is funny because what you're seeing in so we're getting a little bit away from tech right now, but I would say what you're seeing in response to that is an exhaustion with having to say, wait, no, I'm a nice person. And in fact, like, you're the mean person because all of my policies would be nicer for people. So in fact, it's like no one's doing that anymore. What you're seeing is like, yeah, I'm a mean person. I am a mean person. Let's move on now.
There's a British writer. He's very old now. Theodore Dalrymple. Who I think one of the essays of his I read about 10 years ago, which actually really fundamentally changed my outlook on all of these things. He used to work as an inner city doctor in Birmingham, and most of his patients came from pretty impoverished backgrounds, you know, all races, but, you know, very much kind of the most impoverished and very low. I think the polite term is very low social capital. You know, these were people with chaotic lives and alcohol or drug dependencies. And but he writes about a lot is an ideology which has has trickled down from the kind of people that you're talking about to really people with very low impulse control, very low social capital. Perhaps they're not the sharpest tool in the box, and who then apply the idea that there are no bad people in the world, and that, you know, nobody really has any agency, but and niceness is just doing what you want, and the results for them are catastrophic. And he did, like, there's one essay he wrote called "The Rush from Judgment," and there's a phrase in there's a I'm paraphrasing lightly, but there's a line in it which has stuck with me forever, where he says, "Experience has taught me that it's wrong and cruel to suspend judgment." And that actually, in most, you know, at best, it's misguided, and at worst, it's a disguised form of sadism to let people who don't know, like people who are just not that sharp, just make catastrophic messes out of their lives because you've decided that being judgmental is the worst thing in the world, and that makes you a bad person. So that insight really, really stuck with me, and I think changed my worldview on this. I used to be, you know, are you some kind of a bad person?
But, really? Yeah, what was that?
I've had a very picaressque life. I was a fully paid up Butlerite pro genderist in the mid aughts. I was going on Reclaim the Streets protests I've done all kinds of things, lived in communism.
You know, I used to be a bit of a communist myself.
The meme, unbelievable. I love it. You did the meme. I'm a bit of a communist myself. But say more. Are you just doing the meme, or were you actually a bit of a communist?
I was
yourself?
Doing the meme, but I was also a bit of a communist myself. Back in my college years, I think it was a reaction to Bush stuff.
To be fair, not unreasonable.
I think sometimes if you're not careful, you feel so strongly about some issue and you're in opposition to this issue of whatever the president is or the figurehead or the movement. You say, I hate that thing. They're so wrong about that. And then the only people agreeing with you have this whole host of other ideas, and it kind of opens you up to something. And I became super briefly radicalized in Marxism. It was like, like an 8-month period. And then I just recoiled immediately back out of it and became an
anarcho-capitalist. Some people have a goth phase, but...
Right. Yeah. Mine are I have these periods of where I was just, I was ideologically very, very different. And I went into anarcho-capitalism from there, another extreme radicalization.
So you must, as an anarcho-capitalist, which I think I know, maybe I need to ask you to explain what that is.
It's a version of libertarianism, basically.
Okay, so can you say for the people out there who are not like deep in California subcultures, can you explain what an anarcho-capitalist
So I've drifted way away from that, right? I've drifted. It's been about a 10-year journey away from that. These days I find myself just. I try and be pragmatic. I just want things to work. Is kind of where I mean.
Don't we all?
It's
apparently
like
not.
The bar is really low at this point.
For real.
The ideology, the sort of utopian ideologies, they're not for me. But anarcho-capitalism is really the world of. Ayn Rand did a good job depicting it, or what it should be, and we're talking about a world where there is no government, and every relation between people is mutually agreed upon, contracted, paid for, and everything just works because of it. It's like a market-based utopian vision.
It strikes me as a different version of what if there was no original sin.
It's very much like communism, I find, in that it's like, well, what if everybody just behaved in a slightly better way?
What if communism, but people didn't have to be bullied into it?
Yeah. I guess I will say, in the defense of the anarcho-capitalists, the communists require humans to change the way they are. Anarcho-capitalists try to think of a world that would work if the politics were different, and because of the way that people were, they believed, you know, this is actually how humans act in their own self-interest, and so we should model something around that that is nonviolent. It was like super, you know, this is like it is the more pure version of libertarianism, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, even if you've moved away from anarcho-capitalism, I mean, you've covered in considerable detail the proposals to introduce a wealth tax in California. This must be something, surely, that you feel pretty strongly about.
I think it's the most important issue in my life, probably.
Can you explain why that is?
So, I guess at the highest level, A wealth tax is not a tax, right? It is the seizing of assets, first of all. This is a different relationship between the government and the person and the citizen. We're talking about, in a sense, revoking our right to property, to private property. You have a wealth tax, you know, what is actually this law saying? So you have a union-backed ballot proposition in California. California is a state where it's very easy to pass laws for regular ass people off the street to pass laws. They have to gather enough signatures, they can get something on the ballot, and then people will vote for it. Now, everything in politics comes down to money. It's like, how much money do you have to spend to convince people to, first of all, sign onto a ballot, and then to learn about your issue and vote for it. But the unions have like unlimited money because of the structure of our politics in California. So they have enough money to game the system, not even game the system, to just operate within the rules of the system and pass ballots. This one was from the SEIU. They're a healthcare workers union. Their goal was to take 5% of the wealth of all billionaires. And they say they're going to do this to pay for a budget hole in Medi-Cal, California.
And so if I understand this right, I mean, the difference between a wealth tax and just like, if I pay tax to HMRC, I may have emotions about it, but that's essentially like a chunk of the money which sits in my bank account, which then gets sent to the government. But a wealth tax, if I understand you right, will be a little bit different in the sense that, you know, once you're past a certain scale, you know, it's not just some money in an account. It's
things
that you own. It's shares that you own, or it's houses, or it's...
We're talking about your wealth being assessed. We're talking about a state bureaucrat coming into your home and looking at your clothes and your art and your jewelry. And then, of course, more importantly, most importantly, all of your shares in SpaceX, all of your shares in every single privately held company, tallying it up and saying, no matter, you've obviously already paid taxes on all of these things, you pay taxes on your income, but now they're coming into your world and they're saying, well, this is all the things that you have, you know, separate from any kind of exchange. Most taxes, like some kind of sale has taken place, or an exchange of money has taken place. And that's the point of taxation. This is completely like, we're going to investigate you. We're going to determine how much you're worth, and then we're going to demand 5% of it. So what that does is it changes the relationship between the state and the citizen in such a way as like, you're effectively only ever borrowing your own property from the government. They can say at any time, well, we're going to take another 5%. And of course, they'll use this language, and people focus on the language, this sort of like do-gooder language of, well, don't you want to pay your fair share? And both sides do this. So obviously, the people proposing it focus on the language, but the people who are against it often focus on like reacting against that language. Like, no, he's already paid his fair share and things like that. And that doesn't matter. The conversation is completely not that. It is like, this is a different kind of money taking from people that will change our relationship to the government in America. It's also just extremely damaging. So immediately you had a massive wealth exodus. I talked to something like 20, it's more now. I forget when I wrote the piece about it. It was like 22 or 23 different billionaires about that. There are only 200 something in the state of California. So I talked to probably a little under, I think they're like 250. So it was under 10%, but it was close to that of the amount of people who'd be impacted by this. They all have a plan to leave. I think all except one I talked to had a plan. They had a tax guy working on a scheme. They were looking at property. A lot of them were like, I'll pay this because I have to. There was a date that they got caught behind. If this passes in November, it's now on the ballot. It could be withdrawn. We don't know if it will be or not. There's all sort of internal politics. The union could withdraw it if they get something from the governor. They're trying to bribe people right now. We'll see what happens. But if it makes it to the ballot in November and it passes, people are going to leave.
So what does California look like minus its billionaires?
It's not just the billionaires. So it would be the billionaires and their companies.
Their feudal retinues.
I think the reason this is especially dangerous when it comes to the world of technology and building businesses and tech businesses is there are so many people who are, you know, paper billionaires. Like, you become a billionaire with a valuation change. Maybe your company is worth $1 billion. Then how much of that company do you own? Are you worth $1 billion? If, as the authors of this bill claim, you have 5X voting rights on, let's say, a $200 million stake. Now it's worth $1 billion in their mind, and you're going to be taxed, but you don't have any cash at all. So where do you get the money? You have to sell a massive chunk of your company to get the shares, to pay the government, and then you lose control of your company, which is where I think this is really all going. And what this is really all about is control, is tech people, tech money is too powerful. According to the left, they've seen the way that it has had an impact on American politics broadly. Certainly at the local level in San Francisco, it had a massive impact. There was tech money behind every single political change from Bowdoin to the Board of Ed to the mayor. And all sorts of supervisor races. Tech has had a huge impact in the last 6 years on bringing San Francisco to a place of, I don't want to call it sanity just yet, but it's much better than it was.
So if I'm hearing you right, this is one of the unions in the state that wants to bring a rival power base to heel. Is that the macro story that we're looking at?
That's
here?
My story.
Okay,
that is my read of. I think that some people find this to be a bit conspiratorial. They're like, no, why would the unions not want tech in the state? And I look at it and I say, why would they want them in the state? All they have ever done is oppose them. Of course you want to get rid of tech. If you could convince technologists to flee California with their tail between their legs, that would be a great for terrible for California, but amazing for the unions. So I think I would say I'm confident that that's what this is about.
So is this what you would characterize as the Luigi left, or is that something different?
I think that it is. I don't want to put all of that on the unions. You know, I think the union left in the state is not quite as psychotic as the Luigi left.
So
I think
you're going to have to unpack the Luigi left.
The Luigi left. So Luigi Mangione assassinates Brian Thompson, a healthcare executive in New York City in broad daylight. And
don't they make votive candles for him now? I'm pretty sure I've seen that.
Immediately, Luigi becomes a folk hero.
He was weirdly canonized in a kind of
instantaneously. Yeah. He became a folk hero among not even just the hard left, I would say any economic populist. So there's a bit of that on the Trump side too. I knew Trump people who were like, I wouldn't want to say they were pro Luigi. It was always, you know, I'm not saying what he did was right, but, and I just think that.
But I don't like my healthcare company either.
Right. So he became a folk hero for this idea that, you know, our insurance companies are evil and actually they're doing violence to us. Don't care if they die, which is the thing that people are still saying to this day. I would say that's almost the mainstream opinion at this point.
I mean, like the NHS sucks, but I have to be honest, from the outside, it looks like, you know, the American system has some issues as well in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that our system is terrible, but I think...
But equally, you know, we don't go around assassinating NHS managers.
Right.
Nobody should go around assassinating anybody, frankly.
Well, what happens once the assassination takes place is it becomes a meme. And at that point, I mean, the moment I saw it, so Luigi, this is the part that people really don't speak much about with Luigi. It's always, you know, it's the healthcare thing, it's the normalization of violence, which I do think I was early to writing about, but... with Luigi's case in particular, it wasn't just that he was violent. There was this really compelling story there. He seemed like he wanted to create a meme. He scrawled messages on the bullet casings.
That's right, yeah.
He was super attractive. He was this like strangely charismatic figure who was telling us a story, which wedged into our mind. And what I saw when that happened, immediately what I thought about was Columbine, which is a different kind of killing. It is a mass shooting. It is in a school. But what happened with Columbine, so it's like a different class of violence, I would say, than it certainly is a different class of violence than political assassinations. They're a little more chaotic. Well, we don't have to get into the minutiae of how they're different. They're obviously different. But how they are the same is that they created a meme. Mm-hmm. So Columbine becomes a meme that is inescapable in America for the next 20 years. We're still inside of it. Okay. People are still copying the Columbine shooters, not just by going into school and shooting, but it's this whole idea of like being an outcast who is bullied too hard, who strikes back. Like these ideas come from Columbine and we repeat them again and again and again, and we're trapped inside of it. This, I believe, the moment it happened, I thought and wrote about, I said, this is, we're going to be stuck. This is a new form of killing. This is, we've had assassination periods in America before. There was an assassination culture, I would call it, in the 60s and 70s when it was a meme and it was happening again and again in mostly American politics. This was a version of that, but spreading rapidly across the social internet. And then I think the real change here was it wasn't a politician. He was a corporate executive. So suddenly if like executives are on the table, certainly journalists are on the table.
Well, and were.
Writers, podcasters, yeah. And then what happens is Charlie Kirk.
That's right.
And what happens when you look at the Charlie Kirk killer? So now you have this sort of lunatic right-wing Israel, Jews did everything people talking about how, you know, they're really kind of, I think, obfuscating the obvious details of this case, which is that like, this was a person who thought that Charlie Kirk was doing violence to trans people. He had scribblings on his bullet casings.
It's the same.
Okay. Again, it's the yeah. same. It is just, it is literally it's the meme.
Yeah.
It is brought to life. We once again, to simplify this, had Luigi not happened, Charlie Kirk would still be alive. That is what I believe.
Plausible, actually.
I truly believe that had Luigi not killed Brian Thompson, Charlie Kirk would be alive right now. I think that meme is just coursing through our politics right now, coursing through our culture right now, and it is infecting this, you know, small fraction of people who are hyper susceptible to this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
I think it is going to keep happening. I don't know how to stop it at this point, to be honest. I think that it is where we're going to be for a while, just like school shootings.
Yeah, I get it was someone on the left who coined the phrase stochastic violence. You know,
yeah.
This idea that you can meme physical assassination attempts or other, you know, acts of violence into existence by trash talking somebody vigorously and broadly enough online. You know, eventually somebody will be inspired to have a pop at them in real life.
Yeah.
And somehow, even though it was coined on that side, it seems to be directed not at, I don't know, maybe there are acts of stochastic violence directed at leftists as well, and I'm just, they're not in my filter bubble. That's possible.
No.
But it does, you know, there was the Luigi and then Charlie Kirk. There have been several attempts at Donald Trump.
Yep.
And assorted other things have happened.
Hey there, folks. For over 25 years, Socrates in the City and I, yours truly, have been having wonderful conversations with some of the leading minds of our time on the big questions. We think that what we're doing is important and we need your help. Would you go to SocratesInTheCity.com/donate this month? This month we're doing a matching campaign. All of your donations are doubled. SocratesInTheCity.com/donate. It's very important we get this out, what we do, to the widest possible audience, and your help makes it possible for us to do that. Also, while you're at SocratesInTheCity.com, please feel free to sign up for our newsletter and tell us what conversations you've enjoyed the most and what conversations you'd like to see in the future. Thank you.
And there, my sense is, I'm being oversensitive here, but there's people wouldn't like the kind of people who meme, you know, who wouldn't mind that happening or who would celebrate if it did, wouldn't mind at all if it happened to Elon Musk.
Of course, God forbid.
But you see what it's in the ether that he's a terrible person and he's a this and he's a that and I don't think anybody should be like physically assassinating public figures, you know, to be clear.
Shocking. A shocking point here on the show. Horrible assassination.
Yeah,
terrible.
It's a bad thing. Nobody should be doing that.
Uh-huh.
Let's be crystal clear about this. Nobody on any side should be treating political assassination as a means of continuing the discourse. That shouldn't be a thing. And yet here we are. And you can see other potential targets sloshing around in the discourse. I don't think I'm being fanciful there.
Well, so it's even a meme on the left. I mean, obviously, I think that the killing, Luigi himself is a meme, but I'm saying there's another meme. It's has it happened yet? Which is a leftist meme, and they're talking about the killing
it's
of
as
Donald
direct
Trump.
As that.
It's constant. Go on Reddit, go on Blue Sky. It is constant and daily.
Wow.
People are requesting the assassination of Donald Trump.
They're kind of like dialing an Uber, but like, you know, will somebody answer the call, please?
Has someone done it yet? Has it happened yet? This is someone just yesterday on Blue Sky, Pope Hat, went massively viral for justifying preemptively the assassination of Elon Musk. He, I don't have the exact quote here, and so I don't want to distort it. But
probably shouldn't give the meme any further airtime.
It was bad enough that he was
anyway.
That he was banned. Yeah. He was banned from Blue Sky for it. Mm-hmm. After it went wildly viral, and it went wildly viral with lots of likes because it's a very popular opinion. Mm. This is how a fraction of the left, which I think is a much larger fraction than people are comfortable talking about, thinks about the world. It is like, these people are bad. Bad people should be killed. And I think, you know, there's a famous saying. I think it's a saying at this point. Maybe someone said it and now it feels like a saying, which is they don't kill you because you're a Nazi. They call you a Nazi so they can kill you. And
yeah, I've heard that definitely.
And this is where we're at. So that's roughly, you know, assassination culture and the assassination of anyone deemed political, which in the age of the internet is literally everybody who participates in the internet, is not only normalized but in fact celebrated.
So do you anticipate this bleeding into the politics of tech? I mean, it seems...
What already has. So
Elon, right.
Someone already tried to kill Sam Altman. So twice. There was a shooting and a fire... someone threw a Molotov cocktail at his house.
Wow.
Like, this is already... Every single one of these CEOs walks around now. I've been in Silicon Valley for 15 years. The change has been staggering. Back in the day, you could access any one of them, walk up to them on the street. Now they walk around with an entourage of, like, many bodyguards, and the reason is not because they have an inflated sense of self-worth or something. It's because they're constantly getting death threats. Yeah. And when you say that out loud, when you write about it, you know, you're told, oh, you're a bunch of cowards or crybabies. Oh, you got death threats, and it's like, right, no, these are credible death threats.
People are now trying. Like, there's a movement to stop the proliferation of data centers.
Yeah.
Which seems to me it's bipartisan. You know, it's not everybody on either side. You know, it's a much more fractal discourse than that. But there are factions on both left and right who oppose the rollout of data centers and who will try and firebomb them. I seem to remember there was an incident where somebody, you know, there have been physical attacks on the infrastructure.
Yes, there was recently. And I think that's such a confusing, I think no one quite knows why there's this strong...
What's your read on it?
So my take, which people constantly disagree with, is I think it's a proxy for class. And I think class is the issue that's animating people right now. This idea that the rich have everything and I can't afford rent. And the thing about that is both of those things are true. The rich are very rich and people are having a hard time paying for their rent. Mm. I just happen to believe that the reason people are having a hard time paying their rent is not because Elon Musk is very rich. It's because of policies that have been run almost exclusively by Democrats in every city in the country for the last 30 years. But that's I believe data centers are a proxy for that. Yeah. And that's something that both right-wing and left-wing populists agree on.
You can make the case that, you know, just by virtue of what it does, I mean, it's potentially eliminating the lanyard class, you know, which you may see as a good thing. But, you know, other people are going to read, I think accurately, as, you know, yet another turn in the obliteration of the middle class, which was actually, to be fair, you know, that was well advanced already with deindustrialization.
Yeah.
You know, the rollout of the information
globalization
society.
Did that, yeah.
Globalization, deindustrialization was really what began the hollowing out of the bourgeoisie, you know, the industrial middle class, you know, broad-based prosperity, if you like, and yeah, that's been going on since the mid 20th century. But I think and what such bourgeoisie as there is left is really the lanyard class now. And if AI then completes the obliteration of the lanyard class, you've got nothing left except bum wipers at one end and plutocrats at the other.
Yeah.
And I think people are not totally unreasonable to be alarmed by that prospect.
I think that's all true, but those are not absolutely those things are true, and I think that they should be alarmed. But those are not the people that are blocking data centers. It's like what you see if you go to one of these meetings, it'll be like classic. They're a combination of things. So we just wrote a piece about a center, the Micron facility in upstate New York you have a California environmental organization trying to block the construction of a New York State data center. It is completely incoherent. It's just like a general leftist cause. You have people who don't like the way they look, and they go to the meetings and they talk about
that. They're kind of ugly.
They are hideous, for sure. But that's when they go to the meetings. And I'm not here to say that people who are against data centers are wrong, though I think that they are. That's not what I'm just trying to get at. What is the truth of why they don't like them? And if you listen to these people, it's like, I don't want it in my neighborhood. I don't want it in my backyard. And that's a NIMBY. That is someone who doesn't want it. They're fine with it conceptually. They don't want it in their backyard. Theo, I don't want to get too maybe immediately pop cultural, but there are people who just, you know, on podcasts will say they don't like them. They don't like data centers. What, they don't need data centers. Okay, well, like the internet is built from data. We already have data centers. We've had data centers. They've been in Virginia. They've been in Texas. We're using data centers right now. Like, what are you talking about? What do you actually not like? And if I just don't think it's about, I don't think most of the anger is about artificial intelligence, which the average American doesn't even engage with yet, and certainly doesn't believe that jobs are going to be taken away by artificial intelligence. I think it's just like that rich tech asshole has so much. And the cost of beef is now too expensive. I think it's more like that.
Yeah. So one of the proposals that floats around that's quite a good way of phrasing it, is to put the data centers in space so that you just don't have to have these arguments, or to put them on the ocean so you don't have to have these arguments. And that, you know, whether or not that's actually technically feasible or just completely insane, I mean, it sounds very sci-fi, but it feels to me like a really good metaphor for one of the attributes of the digital revolution as such, which I think is also a component in these very confusing and conflicted politics, which is the inherently transnational quality of the technology. I mean, there's a sense in which functionally I live, despite the fact that I live, you know, a 7-hour flight away from the United States, functionally I live in the American sphere of influence, because the American internet encompasses me by virtue of being an English speaker and by virtue of being a Twitter addict, etc. Yeah, but a bunch of other factors. I mean, like functionally I'm part of the American discourse, even though in other respects I'm not. And there's a really interesting, and I think sometimes quite challenging set of tensions that introduces into geopolitics. For example, there's a large scale version of it, and then there's also the sort of the microcosmic level. So, for example, there's an ongoing tussle. You know, the U.S. State Department is very keen on discouraging the European Union's pushes for digital, quote unquote, digital sovereignty. So building their own tech stack, which is independent from the American one. There are ongoing battles back and forth between the United States and the old world over freedom of speech and speech regulations. And there are implicitly there are governance issues there, you know, which sort of intersect with national politics and geopolitics. And then at the microcosmic level as well, it introduces a sort of a solvency to national politics. So, I mean, H-1Bs, I think, is one of the flashpoints here. You know, in a sense, it's in the economic interests of the tech industry to be able to import the best workers from anywhere. That seems obvious. But then that introduces a level of friction into people's neighborhoods, and there's a very complicated set of, you know, concrete ground level social issues that emerge there. I seem to remember one of the early flashpoints in the relationship between tech and the right was that huge spat when Elon Musk was like, "Oh yeah, H-1B is great," and MAGA went bananas. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that sort of stands as it's just one instance of a persistent tension between a technology which seeks to spread itself as widely as possible, and which really benefits. It benefits from being as interoperable as possible, and in some respects, particularly where it comes to AI, as centralized as possible. You know, you want everybody on the same or similar platforms. And what that how that maps to national politics, I think, is a very open question. So I wonder if you have what your sense is of how that is developing.
Well, I think you're exactly right. Technology is inherently, its perspective is inherently global because it scales globally. So that has always been the perspective of the average technologist, is thinking about the world, not about the nation. And in the earliest days, to go to back to the sort of top of this conversation, that was the natural attraction to the left, which is the party, the Democrats are the party of globalization.
There's a fantastic quote in Barack Obama's autobiography where he talks about going to visit Google. I think this is in the aughts. And he went and they showed him a map of all of the Google searches that were happening all over the world, in this sort of data visualization, and this area lights up with this term, and that area lights up with that term, and he describes having this. It's like a spiritual epiphany, the way he's taught, this wonderful unified world where everybody's all just one, and all the borders melt away, and we're all just the same people, and the guy in Delhi and the guy in London and the guy in America are all just part of this marvelous interconnected matrix, and it's all just one world, and that was. I mean, that was the utopian version of the story. But in a sense, the vision and the technology is still pulling us in that direction, even if it's not quite as Obama flavored as it used to be.
It certainly does. That generation of technology certainly does. There's a question about things like cryptocurrency, if that's inherently nationalizing, or at least
please say more about
fragmenting.
I'd love to hear more about this.
Case for Bitcoin versus the state is that it makes it. If you have control of your money and it can't be inflated away artificially by the government, and it can't even be seized really by the government. I mean, this was the promise of Bitcoin originally. These were anarcho-capitalists who designed Bitcoin. Their goal was to create something that was safe from the state. It couldn't be inflated away, and it couldn't be seized. And so if those two things are the case, then states are going to become much smaller. They have to be smaller because they can't raise enormous amounts of money to fund their militaries and police their borders and things like this. And this is a very, again, this is like an anarcho-capitalist thing. So not exactly my wheelhouse anymore, but that is where the technology of Bitcoin came from. This desire to shrink the states, smaller states, fragmentation globally, no new world order. And it is like really the opposite of the like Google, we're all one, we all police the globe kind of worldview. And the technology itself then, within the world of technology, those are the two directions. You have really, I guess you would say, maybe it's crypto on one side and AI on the other side. AI being the total unifying voice of God type thing that we're building.
So is that the new left and right, crypto and AI?
Within tech, I think so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So which one's which? This is being silly for a minute.
Well, this is why. Oh, which one is which?
Which one is left wing? Which one is right wing?
Right. So I think crypto is a little bit right wing, and I think that AI is. It feels to me inherently left wing, and I think that's why you're seeing another culture shift in the technology industry. People tend to go to what is happening. And what was happening over the last 4 years was not just a reaction to wokeness. It was not just a reaction to the animosity the tech received from the press. It was also a reaction to what was working inside of technology, which were companies like SpaceX. And there was a new defense technology company called Anduril. And these companies were less woke. And so people became less woke because they wanted to be like those companies. Now it's AI. And AI, all of the model labs are run by safetyists. Safetyists are kind of left wing, in my opinion.
Actually, this is a great segue onto the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is tech and philosophy. Now, if I understand, you actually have a journalist now at PirateWise on the philosophy of technology beat.
Yeah, we just hired him.
You just hired him?
Yep.
So you found the guy. But I want talk to me about why you think this is so important. Now, why do you need somebody covering the philosophy of technology as a regular beat, a reporting beat?
So
Can you characterize the philosophical splits?
The
like,
technology
what
industry,
are the factions?
The technology industry has always been a super idealistic place, but not until the world of artificial intelligence has it been so completely dominated by strange ideas, super not normie ideas, like schools of ideas, groups of people who have come together and shaped whole idea systems. So I would say you have Bay Area rationalists, you have the effective altruists. Safetyism is a kind of form of both, and then a million things that I don't yet understand myself. You know, I see these
Bay Area rationalists, effective altruists, safetyists. Can we do the like two line rundown of what each of these things what each of these are for the Brit?
Well, I want to say that, one of the reasons that I hired the journalist is like I don't feel confident that I fully understand them as well as I should myself. They're all shaping every single major model lab. They work there. They run the culture there. But let's just do rationalists in EA. So rationalism is just a group of people who want, maybe it just sounds like what it is. They want to maybe tackle every subject from first principles and be exactly rational on everything from the local politics issue to how should we approach the construction of a safe artificial intelligence. Whereas the effective altruists are a group of people who have a lot of rationalists in their ranks, who have a rationalist worldview, who, you know, these tend to be atheists, these tend to be highly intelligent people who have, I don't want to be pejorative, I don't want to make fun of them here. They do tend to be smart people, but their smartness is part of their identity. Mm-hmm. And the way that they go about learning about the world in a rational way mm-hmm. is part of what makes them feel good about themselves.
So they're like different denominations of the same thing. Like, I don't know, Methodists and Presbyterians or something
I would say, I think EA is kind of interesting. Effective altruists are, the idea of effective altruism was really just like, how do we spend money in a way that objectively does the most amount of good? And so, for example, they might look at someone who's like, we're going to build a bunch of schools in Africa. And an effective altruist would be like, okay, but how much good did it really do? Probably not a lot in the grand scheme of things. Maybe it would have been better to focus on internet in Africa, and then everyone could educate themselves or something. Mm-hmm. Like they might look at it that way. It, like, let's spend our dollars on broadband internet access rather
than the joke is about they end up saying, well, actually, we should look after the welfare of shrimp because
right.
there are so many of them.
So another aspect of the effective altruists is they want to reduce the amount of harm in the world, and so they have this weird, it would seem weird to the average person, framework for getting to that. They have now found artificial intelligence, and with effective altruists, it's like a multi-front issue where it's like, one, what is AI going to do to people potentially? But then also two, what are we going to do to the AI? If the AI is conscious and consciousness is valuable, and like the degree of consciousness is the valuable thing, then, we have to think about things like the welfare of the AI. And so that is where, you know, these are the kinds of things that are bubbling up in the Bay Area and have been, not just now. I mean, these are relatively old. You know, these are like 20-year-old idea sets that are now just extremely relevant because they're running the most important companies in the world.
I suppose if you develop a technology that seems to extend thought, you know, even bracketing the question, the hard problem of consciousness, you know, it forces a whole set of metaphysical issues that people have just parked for some time. Mm. You know, what is a person? You know, do we have souls? You know, is the life after death? You know, what is consciousness? You know, all of those. It stops being quite so easy to just swerve those questions and focus on just doing stuff.
Yes.
You actually have to confront some, which I guess is how Anthropic have ended up sort of reversing into the Vatican, or at least attempting to, perhaps. What do you make of that?
The
Anthropic and the papal encyclical.
Well, I think. I think both sides crave approval in some way. I think that Anthropic wants the mark of legitimacy that comes with the Pope. That team seems to really care about this, the status of hierarchy. They want it's the White House struggle with them right now is interesting because they really want the government. The official state, the White House, to have Anthropic be like the official sort of AI company. Mm. I think they crave that stamp of legitimacy from the Pope as well, and the Pope, I think, craves some kind of maybe relevance. And this is very new and it's happening. He seems to care a lot about it. He just wrote all about it. He thinks this is going to be akin to like the Industrial Revolution. And I think he's probably right.
I wonder if it's actually, if it's more than that. You know, you look at, so some of these companies are building out infrastructure at so fundamental a level that it's on its way to becoming the enabling technology for states as such. And at that, you know, you were talking earlier about wealth taxes as rewriting elements of the social contract. But at the point where a private company is providing the plumbing for state governance, I think you are functionally rewriting the social contract in ways that I don't think people have really got to grips with yet at all. I mean, the closest parallel I can think of really is company states like the East India Company in the 18th century. You know, Britain sent these, well, it was basically a joint stock corporation off to run parts of the British Empire just as their private fiefdom, you know, and they could extract, you know, to their heart's content, and they were just in charge of whatever happened there. And I mean, the end of that story was that Queen Victoria nationalized it after some fairly horrible things happened. But I don't know where this story ends. I mean, but it's a relation between private enterprise and the state that we just don't really have a contemporary vocabulary for at all. And you know, I wonder if that's also feeding into, you know, in a very inchoate, very sort of chaotic way, some of the lower level sort of popular fear and hostility surrounding these technologies, because people intuit that actually, you know, the tectonic plates are shifting at a very fundamental level in terms of how these entities relate to one another. And just to bring that back to the Vatican, which was what made me think about this. I mean, in the pre-modern world, the role of the church was, you know, the Roman Catholic Church was really the only institution which had the standing to make any kind of moral admonition to the various absolute monarchies and emperors who were running things. You know, nobody else really had the standing to do it, and it's a different kind of power to hard power, you know, military power or governance power or legislative even, really. It's you know, moral authority is a different kind of power, but the church was really the only body that had that standing. And I was looking at this very sort of cautious rapprochement between the Vatican and Anthropic, and thinking, is this that again? Is that what we're looking at? I don't know. I don't wonder what you think of that.
I think that Well, I think that separate from the question of the Pope and faith, first, the idea that you mentioned of AI is becoming the foundational layer of everything, that is the point, right? Mm-hmm. And that is clearly what's happening. Mm-hmm. I think that you're right that has not been discussed enough. We've already seen it with the military, and this is the conflict that you had between the U.S. government and Anthropic initially. Mm-hmm. If AI is now the base layer of everything, from intelligence reporting to target counting and things like this, if it's literally everything, then what this model company decides, are within the terms of its are inbound in its terms agreement, will shape what you're allowed to do militarily. Yep. And so we have an unelected, potentially unelected corporate executive who is determining foreign policy, which can
this
happen.
This is a live issue in the UK as well, in terms of the relation between Palantir and the delivery of various public services. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very bitterly contested issue at the moment. For very similar reasons, you know, this is a foreign company. You know,
well, but the way that it's,
how do we feel about that?
I would say that probably what's fueling the animosity towards Palantir is more political in nature, because
that's
the leaders,
right,
of Palantir are right wing.
100%. But the underlying structural issue, I think, is a real one.
Well, no, because your civil servants are using Palantir. They are in the driver's seat. So it's whoever is in power of this tool. And Palantir's approach to this is totally different than Anthropic's. Mm-hmm. The difference here is that, so the entire argument that took place in the US had nothing to do with the government using Anthropic. The government was using Palantir, and Anthropic reached out to Palantir and they said, you may have violated our terms of service by working with the government on this or that issue. Nothing was done. Nothing was revoked. But that was the fear, was that the base layer that we're not even working with is shaping what we're doing. We're no longer in the driver's seat. This is no longer a powerful tool that we like or we don't like that's doing very powerful things. This is like
somebody else is
executive
writing the terms.
Deciding what the policy is even allowed to be. And Palantir has never done something like that. Their whole, I mean, everything they've ever said has been the opposite. Like we don't believe in this conceptually. That is not the purpose of a technology. The government buys technology and it does what it will with it. And so that's the philosophical that's the terrain.
I mean, I think this is a pretty vivid illustration of why you would want a philosophy of technology reporter on the beat.
Yeah.
That's a fairly comprehensive answer to that question.
Yeah, we are in the early stages. I mean, we're still just piecing it together. So
one final question. Do you really actually seriously think that the moon should become an American state?
Well, listen, I do think it's ours.
What?
We'll just maybe start there. I think it's finders keepers. We planted our flag. I think it belongs to us. So let's just walk it back a little. I think that the idea that everything in outer space, which was, according to the Outer Space Treaty, I think it was the UN Treaty, everything off Earth belongs to everyone on planet Earth. And that's just ridiculous. All of the known cosmos, I mean, the entire universe belongs to every person on planet Earth. Like, what does that even mean? I think more importantly, you have a tragedy of the commons issue. When nobody owns anything, what happens to it? It's like no one's taking care of it either. I think that the idea that we can't move into outer space without violating some ridiculous treaty is a limiting factor that is inhibiting the progress of humanity. I think that we need to be able to move onto foreign bodies and bring humanity there, which means bring civilization there, which means bring our countries there. You know, the United Kingdom planted a flag, or the British Empire planted a flag in the New World, and that was really great for humanity long term. I think we do need to move forward. So do I think it should be a state? I think it will become the territory of a foreign power, certainly, or of a power, certainly. And I think the question maybe people have to ask is like, would you rather a Chinese moon or an American moon? And that's maybe how some people who are less into the concept of, you know, going off and colonizing new worlds could get into this question is like, let's be realistic about...
I hate that I have an answer to that question.
What is your answer to that? Okay.
I hate that I have a view on that now. Thanks for that, Mike.
But I think that you have to, that you're going to have to decide. The Chinese are already trying to get to the moon. And it's like, who do you want there? That's how I feel about Greenland as well. And I think that's actually the tension with Greenland. There's a whole conflict in the Antarctic as well. It's like, who do you want in these places? And I believe in an America that grows. I think that was essential for the American spirit and for the human spirit. I think we need to keep moving forward. And the moon for me is kind of totemic in this way. It's like my orienting. It's like my true north more than, you know.
So what are you most optimistic about in tech and politics and culture? Then in the intersection of those three, what are you most optimistic about?
I think in a broadly stagnating world, technology is the only thing that is rapidly accelerating. And so I think you can't help but be hopeful that we can use these tools to fix many of the problems facing us, from just economic stagnation to just like a lot of the stuff that we talked about today, crime and cost of housing, and we didn't talk about today, disease, human disease, and like longevity. Certainly, colonizing the cosmos, right? We need better technology to do that. So I think that really every single problem that we're facing, every problem will potentially be assisted by technology. And so I have to be optimistic about just the tremendous gains that we've seen in artificial intelligence, no matter how dangerous it also is. I see a lot of promise there, and I definitely see the future there.
Let's hope you're right. Mike Solana, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been so much fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Socrates Dialogues.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.